The top 1% of America owns 92% of the wealth, and that number has gone up 10x in the last 25 years. Same time, the bottom half of America owns like 4% of the wealth in the country or something, and they basically have been flat for 25 years. History shows on inflation that when everybody realizes they can never stop printing, it's over. You're gonna have a currency event where inflation's gonna be really high, maybe so high that it becomes hyperinflation and the currency collapses.
I think to your point, it's inflation as it's destroying purchasing power. It's nominally inflating the prices of assets, which make those assets further and further out of reach of the average person. And then the people who have those assets have the opportunity to accumulate more and they never have to sell.
The enlightened leader would explain the problem, explain the solution, counsel people that there will be a one-time hit, but then knowing that after that, it's going to be a lot better. If everybody knew it were a one-time deal and after that, it wasn't going to happen again, I think people would be willing to tolerate it, you know, versus you don't change monetary systems without volatility, as anybody who's in Bitcoin knows.
This week, we are having a conversation about sound money, hard assets, monetary debasement, and the potential for a global financial reset with one of my favorite minds in the Bitcoin space and the author of the new best-selling book, The Big Print, return guest of the Block Reward, Larry Lepard. I'm Scott Dietles. I'm the CEO and founder of Block Rewards, and part of our mission in bringing Bitcoin to the workplace is helping people understand how we'll help them. In my opinion, The Big Print is one of the best Bitcoin books that has ever been written, and today's conversation will provide listeners some insight into the career's worth of knowledge that led Larry to write the book and some of the things that you can learn if you do decide to read it. I had a lot of fun with this one, and I hope you enjoy. All right, welcome to another episode of the Block Reward Podcast. This week we are joined by a very special guest, one of my favorite minds in the space, Lawrence Lepard, who is a return guest. Larry, welcome back to the show.
Great to be back with you, Scott, and thanks for having me on. We're going to talk about my book, but I just want to give a shout out to your book. In a way, it inspired me when we met back in Montreal over a year ago, and I saw it and I read it and I thought, this is really good. And then I wondered if I could do something similar. So it was, you planted a seed.
Yeah, I appreciate you saying that, Larry. And it's like, it's just such a cool part of the Bitcoin space, how something like that could happen. And your book is incredible. So to have inspired it at all in any way is a very, very neat thing to.
We all come at it with different points of view. I mean, you bring a lot of Eastern philosophy stuff that I wasn't even aware of. So it was very much new to me. And actually, there was another book up there. I don't remember if you met him or saw him, but that same conference is where I met Pastor Palin Armstrong. And, he had a book on Bitcoin as well and kind of the theological and religious view of it. And actually, I grabbed a few quotes out of his book because they were so good. And so yeah, I mean, we all kind of feed on each other. And it's wonderful the way that everybody brings a different perspective and you can learn, from their perspective. I mean, Jeff's book brought the deflation perspective and, Safe, of course, is the standard book, which kind of covered everything, particularly Keynesianism. And then Lynn just did an unbelievable job of dissecting money and it's kind of the textbook for that. So I think what I brought was kind of the angry American point of view of how we've been screwed. And, I mean, a lot of people ask, why'd you write the book? And I'll tell you, so it was after that conference, around the time of that conference last year, I believe. Where was that 2 years ago now? I'm trying to remember, actually. I get my dates mixed up.
That was 2024. Yeah.
Yeah, it was. Okay. So that I was watching a debate and it was blue team, red team, and they're arguing a bunch of stupid shit. And I was just like, God almighty, doesn't anybody understand that these aren't the issues that really matter, that there's a much bigger issue that matters, and that's the money is broken. And then I thought, and then it kind of germinated in my mind, well, maybe I could explain that, maybe I could write something so that the average person would explain that. Cause these, as blue team, red team, they try and get everybody lathered up to go fight over shit that doesn't matter so that we ignore what really does matter, which if we fixed it would make our lives better. And so that was kind of the genesis of the book, right? Maybe I can explain it in terms. I worked very hard. I had my wife read it. I had a lot of people who were non-Bitcoiners, non-financial types read it in an effort to make it understandable to everybody, to the layman, to the common person. It doesn't matter where you are. You got a high school education. You can read this thing and you say, and so I broke it into two parts. And the idea was, part one, I wanted to communicate, things are broken. They're really broken. Here's how and here's why. And that was, the problem, which is part one. And then, and that's kind of depressing. And, some have accused me of being a doomster. And I'm not a doomster, but I look at things realistically. and things are broken. And then, you know, part two was, okay, but, you know, that's the bad news. The good news is there's this really great emerging solution, and technology and decentralization are making the world a much better place in so many ways. And, you know, we're going to a much better system. We will get out of these problems. I mean, there'll be some different problem in the future, but the problems that we seem intractable right now, I think will melt away as the money gets improved through, you know, conversion to the Bitcoin standard. So that was kind of that's the quick summary of the book. But within that, as you know, there's a lot more in there.
Yeah. So the book's called The Big Print: What Happened to America and How Sound Money Will Fix It. Maybe we could start at the back instead of the front. And so the idea of you were on the show maybe a little bit more than a year ago, and we were talking about gold and sound money. And for anyone who wants to go back to listen to that episode, you know, sort of your understanding, the origins of your views on these things really predate Bitcoin. And the book starts with a discussion around how money worked differently when it had a closer relationship to gold. So maybe just let's start there with, like, you know, how you view paper money's divergence from soundness over time, like as being this, you know, if you could phrase the problem or break it down.
Yeah, no, I think it's a great thing, because it's not like, I mean, the monetary system right now is very broken. We can talk about that in a minute, but we didn't just jump from it worked great to it's broken. It kind of slipped over all these years. And, you know, I mean, and look, money's been an issue that's been around for mankind for thousands of years. And, you know, there've been, throughout those thousands of years, there've been several different types of money, kind of the precious metals, you know, it's long before Bitcoin, obviously, the precious metals kind of emerged as the soundest form of money because they are geologically constrained. You know, governments couldn't print them. And so, you know, you had to do work and pull them out of the ground. And therefore, you know, kind of naturally, just through the market selection, gold and silver kind of became money, as most people know it, throughout thousands of years of history. However, within that, there were always people gaming the system, you know, either printing paper money and saying this had value, or saying it was backed by gold and silver, or even diluting the gold and silver, you know, clipping the coins. Or, you know, the Roman denarius started off 100% silver and ended up almost 0% silver. So, but it, you know, it was still a coin, and they said it had value, but of course it didn't have the natural metal value that it originally had. And so this is not some new problem that we've just, you know, discovered in the last couple hundred years. And to, you know, just to bring it up to the more modern day, you know, relatively modern day, you know, the founding fathers of the United States, which, you know, the American Revolution was another fourth turning. We're in one now. You know, when they set out to build a new government structure that didn't depend on royalty and, you know, kind of lords, the way that England and Europe was run, they recognized that sound money was a very important thing. They'd had the experience of the Continental failing in 1789. And, you know, they were very wise men, and they knew that having money that wasn't backed, you know, having money that a government could control and print at will would lead to trouble. They knew that. And so in the American Constitution, they put in only gold and silver will be money. Well, that's still in there. The Constitution hasn't been rewritten. It's still there. But of course, you know, all the laws and their interpretation have changed greatly since that time. And we no longer really follow that, obviously. And so I kind of go through, you know, how we slipped from 1789 to, you know, throughout the 1800s. Although in general, in the 1800s, we were on a gold standard or bimetal standard. And in general, inflation, while it was problematic, and another thing I thought was very interesting, it really jumped out at me when I did the research, was just how much wars are what caused monetary debasement. I mean, throughout the 1800s, there were, you know, some instances of inflation, but if you look at them, they were all associated with a war. And if the government was just kind of ticking along and not printing money and gold and silver were money, well, guess what? Things were pretty, you know, stable price-wise. But what happens is a war comes along and the government says, well, you know, we got to fight this war, and it's going to cost a lot of money to fight it. And of course, they could go to the citizens and say, hey, guys, we're going to tax you at 90% to pay for the war. The citizens would go, well, then why are we doing the war? No, we're not doing that. Screw it. We don't want a war. So what they do instead is they don't say that. They say, you know, we're going to have a war. Oh, and by the way, we're going to print money to pay for it. And so you get the 90% tax. You just get it over time as you have inflation. And the perfect example is World War One. You know, it was right after they started, right after the Fed had been established. The Fed was established in 1913. And it allowed, you know, the government to basically issue war bonds and then print money to the banks and then let the banks make the spread by buying the war bonds. And, you know, okay, fine. So, you know, our cost of World War One got paid for in that manner. The flip of that, though, is that the level of prices doubled, literally doubled between pre-war and post-war. So, and of course, that led to all kinds of problems. You know, it led to prohibition. It led to, a lot of lynchings, the Ku Klux Klan rose, there were big labor strife, et cetera. And inflation itself just really hurts, average people. And it, the book, the big theme of the book is that the playing field is the monetary playing field in the world we know or have known is unfair. And it's unfair because it's with a government in, working with a central bank or even pre-central banks, the government had the ability to, create coins and print money, so to speak. And in so doing, and the banks had the ability to print money through fractional reserve lending. And in so doing, they increased the general price level. And the problem is that the working person, if you're just a regular person with a regular job, your salary doesn't go up as quickly as the cost of things goes up. And that's why people are hurting. And so, all the blue team, red team anger, I get it. I mean, it's really bad. What's going on in this country is really bad. The bottom half of this country is hurting really badly. Even the top half is hurting, but they have more of a cushion. They're not living on the edge. And, it's just, it's all because of this unfair monetary system. And, what happens in this unfair monetary system is certain people know how to game it. One of the most shocking charts that I put in that book that I thought was just, it just blew my mind when I saw the statistics was that the top 1% of America, 1% of the population owns 92% of the wealth of this country. And that number has gone up 10x in the last 25 years. Same time, the bottom half of America owns, like 4% of the wealth in the country or something. And they basically, they basically have been flat for 25 years. So it's really, and that's because of the system and the way it's built. And so it's really unfair. And so the book is kind of a call to action. I want to get the average person to realize that, because there are a lot more average people than there are. I mean, the elites control the system, right? And they've set it up in their favor and that's how they get rich and they, they run everything. Well, okay, fine. But if we really have a democracy and we've got a bunch of voters, if everyone really understood what's going on, we outnumber them vastly. And so, we could restructure the system in a way that is fair. To me, that was really the whole American experiment, was that all men were created equal, with the right to pursue, for the pursuit of happiness. And in many ways we've lived up to that. In some ways we didn't, particularly, for many, many years on slavery and all the other stuff. But I mean, we've tried to live up to that ideal, but monetarily we have not lived up to that ideal. And in fact, monetarily it's gotten worse because it started with the Federal Reserve. But, then there were more things after that, right? Then, 1971, we got a quasi-gold standard. Citizens couldn't own and exchange things for gold, but, countries could. And so that put some restraints on how bad they could dilute the money. And, but in 71, Nixon killed that. So what I try to do, the first half of the book is a history lesson on how we went from a country founded by some very wise men who understood the importance of sound money to a country with no sound money, total fiat money, monopoly money, completely out of control and very, very unfair to average people and very beneficial to the wealthy who know how to game it. So that was, I really wanted to do that. And I thought it was important for me to write it. I'm 67 because, I encounter a lot of people in the Bitcoin space and other spaces too, younger people, and they haven't been around to see it. And they haven't watched the progression. They don't remember all the stories. And I do because I was there. I remember when it happened. I remember when LTCM blew up. I remember the GFC. I remember a lot of things. And I thought it's important to kind of try to lay those things out so that people understand this has been a gradual but consistent progression to, a worse monetary system. And in light of that progression, and now we've got to the point where it's beyond all repair. It's a complete mess. And frankly, it's probably going to blow up. And so therefore, the book is a warning to people too. It's not just a call to action to elect politicians who want to return to sound money. But it's a warning that, hey, given this thing's going in a pretty bad direction and might blow up, gee, you might want to protect yourself. And the three forms of protection, really, I mean, the best one is Bitcoin, but gold and silver work too, because the government can't print them. And real estate works to a degree. And stocks maybe, but stocks aren't very cheap right now. So I just want to try and help the average American, because I think the average American is really been abused by this system. By the way, I mean, I'm just writing it from an, and really worldwide citizens, I'm just writing it from an American perspective because I'm an American.
Oh, no, totally. And, I think like as a non-American reader, and we've chatted about this as you're iterating the book, the problem for people in other countries is that we're downstream of the problem of the dollar. So and there's lots of great information about this. Alex Gladstein writes some really good stuff around the exportation of inflation. And this kind of Peruvian bullock concept of the dollar milkshake, where eventually the softer fiat currencies are all in the process at varying speeds of collapsing into the dollar first.
It's worldwide. Yeah, it's worldwide. Yeah, no doubt.
Hey, you know, and I think we see the same problems, and we actually see them worse. So like in Canada, the inflation of residential real estate prices has been like incredibly more noticeable here as our dollar has retained value less. And if you go to Buffalo, you can still buy a house in Buffalo, New York for $250,000. You go just right across the border, and the same house in Windsor is like four times the price, and they're exactly the same house. Yeah. So I think to your point, it's inflation as it's destroying purchasing power. It's nominally inflating the prices of assets, which make those assets further and further out of reach of the average person. And then the people who have those assets have the opportunity to accumulate more, and they never have to sell. So they just sort of see their number go up. And this is kind of like the fundamental root of the problem.
That's exactly right. I mean, I have kids in their 20s and they look at me and say, "Hey, Dad, how am I ever going to buy a house? I mean, they're just too expensive." And that's because BlackRock's out there buying houses. And because housing became a way of storing value, and housing prices, you know, when interest rates were really low. I mean, the other thing the book talks about is just the government policies that were just so misguided. I mean, ZIRP, which stands for zero interest rate policy, and then QE, which is really blatantly money printing. Those two policies really came into play post, 2008 GFC, which I mark as kind of the beginning of this fourth turning. And, it would have been one thing if they'd been very brief, like, okay, we got a crisis, we got to do this for a brief time, fine. But they had ZIRP. They had 0% interest rates from 08 to 15. That was 7 years of free money. And that created a lot of distortions. There's your housing bubble right there.
Yeah. This isn't necessarily directly, this is all in the book. But so we come out of 7 years of ZIRP, and then kind of 5 years later, there's a need for liquidity and, conveniently a great reason to create a bunch of money. And, depending on what country you're in, the money supply in 2020 to 2023 might have been expanded by like 40 to 70%.
Yeah, it was like 40% in the U.S. It's crazy, right?
Could you just talk a little bit about maybe how there's sort of like the problem of diminishing returns on money printing and what that means? So like they printed all this money in 08 and that really got them 12 years, but this last round of money printing in 2020, here we are 5 years later. Like when that happens, the need to do it again accelerates.
Well, that's right. So that's a very good point. And that's what leads me to conclude we're getting closer and closer to kind of, the next quote unquote big print, or perhaps even the final big print, right? I mean, as an example, in 08, let's just look at the math. In before 08, the Fed balance sheet was $900 billion. It took them about three or four years to get it up to, almost $4 trillion. So they printed a lot of money, $3 trillion, but over 3 or 4 years. I mean, Powell, with COVID printed $5 trillion, in 18 months. So, and by the way, it's not, yes. And what they did in 08 lasted until 2020. So they got 12 years out of it. They're not going to get 12 years out of this next print because we're now starting to see signs that the system is too tight, too levered, and they're going to have to print again soon. So we're 5 years after, and my suspicion is within the next few years, we see the problem rise its head again. And that's really what I'm describing, Scott, is, and it's a chart that's in the book, but it's just the notion that you can't grow GDP at a much slower rate than you grow debt, because the GDP pays the interest on and supports the repayment of the debt. So if you grow the level of debt in a society to try and juice the economic, growth and returns, and you don't get a subsequent increase in GDP of the same magnitude, then you're sowing the seeds of a future point in time where there's going to be a crisis. And the crisis, it's von Mises, it can be resolved one of two ways. You can either let things collapse, and deflate the money supply and get back to a base level that's sound. But that's quite painful. That's what happened in the 1929 Depression. Or you can say, we're not going to let that happen. We're going to just print as much money as it takes, keep things running to prevent things from collapsing. But the negative with that is it's like pouring water in your beer. If you have a beer and you add 40% water to it, well, it's going to be pretty diluted beer. And that's really kind of what happens with the value of the money gets diluted. And, it's one thing that's clear, and the book talks about this, but I know probably most of your listeners already know this, obviously, but is that, governments and others will blame inflation on other people, greedy corporations. I mean, they act like it's some mysterious event that they can't prevent. And that's just not true at all. I mean, inflation is very simply, you know, growth in the underlying money supply, because economies have goods and services in them. And, you know, productivity and, you know, population growth lead to more of those over time. But the price for each good or service is driven by how much money is chasing it. So, you know, if we doubled the money supply tomorrow, the price of everything would take a little while, but eventually the price of everything would double, because it'd be twice as much money chasing it. So that's really the underlying problem. It's just this continual money printing and the belief that that's a good thing. You know, the Keynesian model belief that that's the right way to run an economy, which it's not. And the book makes this case very strongly, in my opinion, that, you know, because I'm very passionate about it, that we need to have market-driven interest rates, not Federal Reserve-driven interest rates. And the market would drive an interest rate. And what an interest rate should be, it's the price of money using money over time. And what it does is it balances. Savers have excess money. They've saved money. They put it in the bank, whatever. And borrowers, you know, want to borrow money, and they either want to borrow to consume, which isn't particularly productive. But let's take corporations, for example. They want to borrow money because they want to increase capacity or increase efficiency or whatever. And so, you know, the corporation should do the calculation of, well, does it make sense to borrow this money? And the saver should do the calculation of, am I getting enough return for the risk I'm taking with this particular company? And the two should agree at some price. And that balances the supply of money with the demand for money and investment capital. And so this capital allocation that investors do, that's the most important thing that happens in the economy, because if we waste our capital and we don't invest it in things that increase productivity, then our lifestyles don't get any better. And what's amazing to me, I mean, is that, you know, based on technology, things have gotten a lot better over the last 50 years, but they could be even better still if we weren't doing stupid stuff. And when you have money be free or mispriced, you do stupid stuff. I mean, one, you know, the leading cause of, in my opinion, stupid stuff is you have wars that you can't really afford. I mean, the United States spent $8 trillion in the Middle East to, you know, attack or, you know, Iraq, and, you know, only to give it back. And then now it sells all its oil to China. You know, we attacked, you know, Afghanistan and controlled that for a while, and then we gave that back too. I mean, it was $8 trillion. It was just a massive, you know, misallocation of capital. And it cost us all greatly. I mean, we now have veterans benefits that run $380 billion a year for all the guys who are over there. And they should, you know, we should treat those guys well, but, you know, it's a huge expense, the fact that we have a lot of guys who have, you know, limbs blown off from IEDs when they were serving over there. So, you know, it's really bad. This having a central authority, having 12 people sit in a room and set the rate of interest, it just makes no sense. They can't. I don't care if they're godlike. I don't care if they're the most omniscient, smart people in the world. They could not do it as well as the marketplace can do it. And that's the problem, right? That's the core of the.
There was one of the Doge uncoveries with Elon over the last few weeks, talking about how I think there's 12 different government departments that can actually just infinitely pay invoices without. So they're effectively just creating money endlessly. There are all kinds of different mechanisms that have emerged.
There really are. I mean, sadly, and you know, there's probably stuff that's off balance sheet. I mean, there are a lot of funny things about the government accounting. I mean, one of the things it's always been a mystery to me, is if you actually look at what they report as the deficit in any given year, like, you know, last year was like $1.8 trillion. Okay, so they spent $1.8 trillion more than they brought in tax revenue. But if you look at the amount of debt that grew, the debt burden last year, as I recall, it grew by like 2.6. So, okay, hang on a second. If you're, you know, and the 1.8, they obviously borrowed to fund the 1.8. But where did the difference come from? Where did the other 800, you know, I mean, it's a balance sheet entry, but it didn't run through the P&L, you know, budget deficits, the P&L, you know, the balance sheet is the debt's on the balance sheet. So if the debt grew by, you know, 2.6 billion, well then, or trillion, didn't we really run a $2.6 trillion deficit? It feels like we did. But, you know, again, there are a lot of funny games that go on with government accounting, and I'm not, you know, either smart enough or I don't view it as useful, you know, a good use of my time, try and decipher how that kind of stuff occurs. But the book is actually full of this. I mean, that, you know, the government, I mean, we must remember that governments in general, their number one job is to perpetuate themselves and to protect, you know, if you're in there, to protect yourself and to, you know, stay on the gravy train. And, you know, And that's why the founding fathers put all these checks and balances in. Unfortunately, a lot of them have been overridden. But yeah, there's a lot of nonsense that goes on, and I applaud efforts to stop that nonsense.
Yeah, I mean, and I think you can get reactions from people when you talk about some of these ideas, but it's an apolitical statement to say money printing, you know, provides government the authority to act, you know, as though they've been empowered by the people. And so it's just a system like that. This is not neither good or it's just what happens. And then that's a result.
Yeah. And to be fair, I mean, I think, you know, because it's silent, I mean, at least, look, I mean, we pay our taxes. We know why we pay our taxes because we, you know, we need government to do certain things. The thing about this is it's subtle. It's a silent form of theft. I mean, they're really, you know, they're saying to you, they're saying to anybody who's saved money. I mean, think of the person, you know, post COVID, think of the person who had worked, you know, 10, 20, 30, 40 years, whatever. And they had savings, you know, they did the right thing. They didn't spend everything they earned. They tried to save for a rainy day. And they might have built up, you know, savings of 100,000. Maybe if they were very successful, they got 500,000 or something, you know, getting close to retirement. You know, COVID comes along, they print 40% of the money supply, you know, so that the value, the purchasing power of your savings just went down by 40%, you know, and there's nothing you can do about it. And, you know, the government kind of has stolen all those years of work. I mean, if you're 50 years old, you can't go back and enjoy your young earning years again. I mean, you're at the end of your career, not the beginning. You know what I mean? And the government steals it. And so, you know, as I say, there's a chapter in the book called Sound Money is a Moral Issue. I really believe that's true because unsound money is a sneaky way of allowing the government to steal from people.
Yeah, I mean, and that's actually one of the premises of Pastor Armstrong's book.
Yeah, I know. There's some great quotes in there that I grabbed from him. I really enjoyed his book. It's a great book. I highly recommend it. Pastor Alan Armstrong.
Yeah. Yeah, we had him on the show as well back in this, is it going to be a year ago? Yeah, so that's an episode for people who are listening and interested. You mentioned Fourth Turning, where we're both fans of Fourth Turning. And, you know, one of the parts that I enjoy about the book is it starts with your own personal story, sort of going back three generations and the 20s depression era in the U.S. through the lens of your grandfather owned this furniture store. So, you know, you're really taking a lived personal experience or intergenerational personal experience of yours to frame this, the evolution of how this problem has gotten worse as you, you know, look forward to.
Yeah, it arguably might have even been worse for my grandfather because it was almost existential for them. I mean, they were very close to going bankrupt, but I know it severely damaged my grandmother in terms of her psyche for the rest of her life. They were so close to going bankrupt. But yeah, I mean, one of the things about the book I tried to do is I figured, you know, a lot of people don't read books and people tend to read stories. I mean, even something as simple as the Bible, it's telling lessons, but they're told as stories. And so, you know, and I look at some of the books in the space and they're fabulous books, but they're textbooky sometimes. And, you know, people don't necessarily read textbooks. And so I figure if I told my own personal story and I could very clearly trace how the Federal Reserve had harmed my family three times. I mean, they did it with my grandfather, they did it with my father when Volcker put rates up to 20%. I mean, I recall it very clearly. My father's business almost failed. I mean, he was terrified that his business was going to go under. And that was because they'd gone off the gold standard and inflation had run away. And so they had to, you know, take rates up to 20%. Well, fine. You know, okay, you got the monetary system to calm down, but you damn near put it. I mean, there were other guys who didn't make it. My dad did. But, you know, and then of course with me, I was fine when they changed the rules on me in 08, but, you know, it was totally unfair. You know, I'm playing a game in the middle of the game. They changed the rules. I'm like, hey, what's this all about? To protect themselves. So, yeah, I mean, I've tried to kind of draw that this isn't some new problem and this has been going on for a while and I've lived it directly. And again, maybe that was part of why I wrote the book. I'm just angry that there's a whole narrative. You know, I was at a men's breakfast down here, a lot of successful older gentlemen down in Naples, Florida, where I spend the winter. You know, they were all, I mean, they applaud the Federal Reserve. They applaud Ben Bernanke. They think the system is great. And that's because the system has worked for them. They've made a ton of money, you know, playing the fiat game. And, you know, I never wanted to play the fiat game. I always knew that fiat was fundamentally flawed, even though it's quite persistent. You know, it's been around for since 71. 50 years, a long time, 50 plus years, 40 years now. But I knew it was fundamentally flawed and that it would eventually come a cropper. And so I just wanted to, you know, put out the other side of the case, right? You guys have all bought into this, but you know what? It's not right. It's not fair. And now we're seeing, you know, we're seeing the long run arrive. I mean, Keynes, who I consider, you know, is kind of socialist and I think a, you know, very smart man, but also a short-sighted and arguably even evil man. Said, well, in the long run, we're all dead. Well, that's like saying, you know, let's just eat the seed corn and let our kids starve. I mean, you know, anybody who believes in the future and believes in leaving a better world, you know, we want to plant trees so that they grow up to, you know, yield fruit for our kids. And, you know, his view was, well, no, let's just eat the fruit now. And if we don't plant new trees, who cares? It's, you know, we're all dead. Well, as it turns out, we're now kind of getting to the point where we're at the long run, with this monetary system. I mean, because it's so broken. But let's go back to the fourth turning. Some of your listeners may not know what that is. I don't know. Should I give a brief explanation? Yeah. So, because I highly recommend this. I mean, there are books I recommended, not my book to read. And one of them is The Fourth Turning. And so The Fourth Turning was written quite some time ago. And very visionary, because what these guys saw is what happened. A couple of guys, Howe and Strauss, and one of them still alive, wrote a book called The Fourth Turning. And what it talks about is how you have these generational cycles of within societies of how, things get started, they grow, they mature. And then ultimately you end up in a crisis where something, the system that as it was constructed doesn't work. Societally, it doesn't work. And so we need to, things change, the rules change. The crisis creates a rules change. And on the other side of the crisis, there's a new system again. And then, of course, you get the first turning, and they tend to be about 80 years apart. And they tend to have four different pieces to them, each of which is 20 years, which is kind of a short human lifespan. And so, I believe we're in one. I believe it started in 08. And I think the one before this was World War II, the Depression. So that happened to be about 80 years ago. One before that was the Civil War. Of course, the country was very different before and after the Civil War. And the country was very different before and after, World War II. Another one before that was the American Revolution in 1776, where, we were, overseen by Britain and we were a colony, with some state governments and legislatures, but basically, dependent upon Mother Britain and the crown. And then we said, no, we don't like that. We're not going to do that anymore. You can't tax us. You can't put soldiers in our houses. It's pissing us off. We're gonna form our own country. We'll create a new set of rules. That's what led to the Constitution and the system we live under. So, every 80 years, one of these occurs, and we're kind of due for one now. And I think this one is focused on the monetary system. And it started in 08 when we came within a hair's breadth of the whole thing collapsing. And so, what will get resolved, in my opinion, in this fourth turning is what is money. I mean, I borrowed that from Robert Breedlove, but, what kind of a monetary system should we have? And is it fair to have a monetary system where, the Federal Reserve and the insiders get to create a set of rules that benefits them at the expense of the rest of us? And I think the answer to that question is no. And I think that therefore what will happen, because human beings are smart and they always migrate towards the best solution, is we will migrate towards a solution that moves away from that. And that's what Bitcoin is. So, and we're going to do it either way. And as I said in the book, in the end part of the book, I talk about how it's really the thing that saved us here. A lot of things have saved us. Satoshi saved us by finally perfecting Bitcoin. But the other thing that saved us is just technology and decentralization. I mean, the microprocessor, the internet, we had these big sclerotic, organizations that, could kill millions like, Hitler's, country did, or they could start wars like ours has recently, and they could control the narrative because they controlled all the news sources. They're all kind of, shown to be flawed, shown to be broken and falling apart. I mean, people don't trust the mainstream media anymore. They trust, podcasts, and they trust people, they know that are honest. And so, and this is all because of the technology, which allows everybody to cheaply and easily access podcasts. I mean, it allows you and I to speak to one another from halfway across, from across North America, and then broadcast it out to thousands in real time. I mean, so all of these decentralization things are, taking away the power from those who had it and were abusing it. And of course, the next step in the descent. I mean, the internet was the big one, right? And because it's centralized information, connectivity, communications, all that. And the next big one is money. And, Bitcoin is decentralizing money. You don't need a central bank. You don't even need banks. You and I can transact with each other on chain or on layer two, and no bank needs to be involved. So, we know, and more importantly, we know that we hold a sound form of money that cannot and will not ever be debased. And that's a big deal. I don't think people have focused on how big a deal that is, but it's a really big deal. Looking backwards, it'll be super obvious it was a big deal. Today, it's still kind of murky because people are like, I don't know. And as I talk about in the book, everyone's confusing crypto and Bitcoin, and they're not the same. They're issues, right? But it's becoming clearer and clearer, in my view.
Hey, everyone, quick question. Have you ever thought about starting a video podcast like this one? I want to introduce you to the team behind my show, Podigy. This podcast has been one of the best marketing tools for our business. And thanks to Podigy, all I have to do is hit record. They handle everything else, editing, writing, publishing, and making sure that it's perfectly optimized for every platform. They only work with disruptors, mavericks, and changemakers, people making a real difference, spreading big ideas. Typically, Podigy is fully booked, but right now they have a few spots open for new clients. Listeners of this show get 10% off launching their own podcast or optimizing their current one. Click the link in the bio for a free one-on-one podcast planning session with Podigy. If you are thinking about starting a podcast or you have one and you want to take it to the next level, I can't recommend Podigy enough. Check them out. I mean, and this is another theme that you do such a good job of discussing in the book is sort of just the general malaise around understanding what sound money actually even is and why that concept has value because of how long and how gradual the drift away from it has been. It's like watching an iceberg melt.
That's the thing. I mean, a lot of people don't have the historical perspective. I mean, the average person just kind of thinks, well, inflation, yeah, we've always had inflation. We can't live in a non-inflationary environment. Well, you know, or gold's antiquated. Gold doesn't make any sense. Well, hey, you know what? This country from 1789 to 1946, we built the leading country in the world by almost every measure, you know, industrial output, you know, governance, behaving well. I mean, and there were plenty of times we didn't behave well, don't get me wrong, but you know what I'm saying? I mean, it was really quite an achievement. It was all on a sound money standard. And so since 71 is when I marked the real rapid decline of the sound money, you know, standard. And of course it's gotten, you know, it's increasingly accelerating in the wrong direction. And so, you know, so there it is.
Yeah. I mean, it's certainly up here. I have my suspicions that where the only way to explain a lot of political decisions is that they know though the game's almost over because like there isn't really any other rational way to justify a lot of the things that are being done.
I think that's right. I mean, I think everybody's just trying to grab what they can grab. And honestly, I mean, I don't like both sides. I mean, and I've got family members and friends who are in both camps, and I try not to be too judgmental because it's a very tough time, and it's very easy for people to get tribal, you know. And just because times are tough, you know, you want to find somebody to blame. So it's, my tribe's great, your tribe sucks.
I mean, like both parties, or any party in every country, their collective goal is to stay in power as a government.
That's exactly right. And you know, I think that the sound money offers a lot of hope for potentially a much more downsized government. I mean, look, I'm not an anarchist. I think we need government. But my view from what I read, you know, in school and my study of political science and history is that a government should be a fair referee. I mean, do I want a government? Absolutely. I want a government to give me policemen and courts and rules. And, you know, I want it to be fair. I want to put murderers in jail and I want to prevent people from stealing and all of that kind of stuff. But a lot of the other stuff the government does, I'm not sure I really want them to do it. And my gut is that we could have a really good government that did, it was super honest where, you know, I mean, we, you know, all kinds of things. We had term limits. We had people who could, you know, it wasn't about money. Politicians were paid well and maybe had a package that paid them well for life so they couldn't take bribes and stuff, you know, whatever. But we could have all of that and it would probably cost us all 10% of our income. And so if somebody said to me, look, 10% of everything you earn every year, you got to throw into the government pot so that we have, you know, firemen and policemen and courts and all that stuff, I'd be like, fine. Yeah, absolutely. Let's do that. You know, because and that would be a big difference from where we are today because it's much closer. I mean, government's absorbing, you know, 30, 40%, 45% in some cases of, you know, the productive resources of the economy. And I don't think we're getting our money's worth.
Yeah, and then they're printing on top of it, just like you.
Well, that's right. Yeah, no, yeah, that's just the tax burden. Correct. Yeah, they're doing that, and then of course, if they dilute it at 8% a year, which is the long run average, they're getting that too. So yeah, it's very unfortunate that we've gotten to this position. But again, I'm optimistic because of the technology and because I think people once they understand things and are educated on things, and that's happening. You know, people will migrate towards the right solution. I mean that. The world, I mean, you know, look, we live better today than we did 50 years ago or 100 years. I mean, you know, humankind will continue to make progress. So I'm not a doomer in any sense of the word, but I am, you know, I am concerned about right now, you know, what could happen in some of these monetary areas. I mean, we're going through right now, this is not going to be, you know, a smooth ride. You know, you don't change monetary systems without volatility, as anybody who's in Bitcoin knows, right? there's a lot of volatility in this asset.
Yeah, I mean, and one of the most common sort of objections I get for people who don't fully understand Bitcoin or even understand it a little is governments will never let this happen.
Yeah, it was a great objection until the ETF came out, right? You know, it was a great objection until China banned it, and yet it lives everywhere else. And I think there are people in China who use VPNs to buy it. And, you know, it's kind of game theory. I mean, once you realize what it is and you realize that you've either got to adopt it or get left behind, you know, people will come to adopt it. I mean, I thought Safe, in his book, did a great survey, talked about it. It's like gunpowder. You know, I mean, okay, you can still, you know, you want to do cavalry charges with, you know, spears and knives and axes. That's fine. You can still do all that shit. But guess what? The other side has gunpowder. You're in trouble. They can shoot, you know, bullets at you and shoot bombs at you that are going to blow up. And it doesn't matter how many spears you got or how many swords you got or how many, you know, axes you got, right? So, and that's really, to me, that's what Bitcoin is. Bitcoin is monetary gunpowder because, you know, it's a form of money that cannot be diluted. And so, and that's the other thing history shows is that the soundest form of money always wins. It always does. I mean, that's why gold won out over silver. The flow on gold is, you know, is a much better ratio than stock to flow on silver.
Maybe a two-part question to come back to a few points we were talking earlier. You were talking about Volcker and the high interest rate period of the 80s. And, you know, what we have seen over the last 5 years have been, you know, forays, toes in the water around raising rates. So one of the aspects of this predicament is with the level of debt that exists now, truly raising rates for a prolonged period or raising rates where they would need to go, it would break the system tomorrow.
Absolutely. We actually saw this in September of 2023. The U.S. 10-year went over 5% for the first time in a long time. And within 2 weeks, 12 Fed governors have said, we're done raising rates. And it brought rates right back down. But yes, you're right. The way the system is constructed, you know, they have to, you know, they have to keep rates low. And the only way they can do that is by entering the bond market themselves and buying bonds that no one else will buy. Because the Achilles heel to the fiat monetary system that they have is that, okay, once the bond market, when you're printing money and you're growing the debt, and which by definition is printing money, you are creating inflation. And bondholders are paid a fixed amount of interest, and they don't like inflation. And so as the bondholders come to learn that the system, by definition, is going to continually debase the currency, they start to say, I don't want to own this bond anymore. And that means they sell into the market of fixed size. By selling that bond, somebody else will only buy it with a higher interest rate. And eventually, if those rates get high enough, the government says, well, we can't tolerate this. And they do what's called yield curve control, which is to say, or QE, which is to say they buy it. So, I mean, this is a nice game. I mean, if it's like they can run up their own credit card debt, and then if they can't pay it, they just print money to pay the debt with. And you and I can't do that because we don't have a printing press. The government does, and that's therein lies the problem, and that therein lies the system, and that therein lies my high level of confidence, because the alternative is okay, fine, we're going to stop printing money. Well, then interest rates would go up a great deal, the economy would collapse, and there would be a lot of debt defaults. We're not at the stage where raising interest rates is one of the options that's left to us. I mean, you know, the last time, so in 71, when they went off the gold standard, they had a lot of inflation in the 70s. And the solution to that was Paul Volcker raised the rates. You know, he raised them very high. It went up to 20%, 79, 80, twice. And that actually got people to have faith in the currency again. And we started a deflationary period. But, you know, his debt to GDP ratio was in the 30s. It was like 34%. And our debt to GDP ratio is like 130%, 125%. So if rates here went up a lot, the government deficit would get even worse. And that's, you know, what we've all are referring to as the debt doom loop, which is to say that, you know, the more they spend, the bigger the deficit, the more bonds they got to issue, into a fixed size buyer set of bonds, the higher interest rates go. Oh, higher interest rates affect all that debt you've already got. Oh, so you got a higher interest expense. Oh, so your deficit's bigger. So you got to sell even more bonds. I mean, there's a circle there, right? It's a doom loop of, you know, more bond sales, higher rates, therefore more interest costs, bigger deficits, therefore more bond sales. I mean, it just keeps getting worse and worse. That's the condition that will tell us that we're kind of in the end game to all of this. And that's why, as I say, you know, the three things I focus on every day are what's the 10-year U.S. bond rate, what's the price of gold, and what's the price of Bitcoin. And the reason I focus on the price of gold and the price of Bitcoin is that they are basically, they're the canaries you know, when gold is at record highs like it is now, or Bitcoin is at record highs like it was in December and it's a little below it now, that tells you that the faith in fiat currency is being lost. And, you know, as more and more of that faith gets lost, you know, then the problem gets larger and the bond buyer set is going to get smaller and they're going to have to print even more. And so inflation is going to become a real problem. And what'll, you know, if we're lucky, Scott, what'll happen is we'll kind of naturally and gradually, you know, just migrate over to a Bitcoin standard, which is what I kind of hope for. But I also think there's some possibility that it doesn't go terribly smoothly, that it happens, you know, that gradually and then suddenly model kind of comes into effect. Because, you know, history shows on inflation that when everybody realizes they can never stop printing, it's over. You know, you're going to have a currency event where inflation is going to be really high, maybe so high that it becomes hyperinflation and the currency collapses. I don't want to paint an extreme picture, and I'm not saying that's going to happen. It would take a lot of policy mistakes for that to happen. But, you know, it's not outside the realm of the possible, particularly if Team Blue wins and Stephanie Kelton, who's the MMT guru, becomes the Treasury Secretary, because the MMT school thinks that now it's not a problem. You can print as necessary to keep your economy going. And when asked, what do they don't they worry about inflation? Their answer is, oh yeah, we can control that with taxes. Well, good luck with that. So it's a problem. It's really a problem. But you know, that's the bad news. The good news is there's this great solution. You know, the sooner you adapt the solution, the better your life becomes, the more relaxed you become, the more confident you become that, you know, you're actually going to be better off in the future because your savings are not going to be debased. They're going to go up in value a lot. So that's, you know.
So we had talked about two scenarios there where the government either continues to print or defaults on the debt and there's ensuing chaos. And in the book, you talk about that there is a third scenario, which is the sort of debt jubilee monetary reset.
Right. That's the smart and hoped for way out of this whole thing. I mean, it's, you know, let's try and keep the whole thing really simple. We've got too much debt compared to our underlying capacity. So we've either got to raise the value of our underlying capacity or diminish the value of the debt, both of which are by definition kind of inflationary, or we could default on the debt and have something like the Great Depression. But, you know, what I would suggest that is, you know, and by the way, it's not like this hasn't happened, you know, history rhymes, right? Roosevelt did this in the Depression. I mean, in 1933, he grabbed all the gold and then he turned around and devalued it by 70%. And when he did that, 1934 was the best year of the Depression. We had a mini recovery. Now, because of some other problems, we slumped back down into the Depression for the balance of the decade. But the point is that, you know, if an enlightened leader, and, you know, I hesitate to use that word because there aren't many of them, but an enlightened leader could say, hey guys, we got way, you know, we shouldn't be following Keynesianism. We got way too much debt. You know, we're gonna move to a Bitcoin standard as the underlying base level of currency. We're gonna devalue this debt in Bitcoin terms. The value of Bitcoin would go up quite a bit. And go forward basis, you're gonna know that your money is sound and can't be printed. And a lot of the problems are gonna be solved. Now, having said that, there would be a one-time big inflationary hit. I mean, sadly, you can't get through this without somebody getting hurt because, you know, the market for certain things is mispriced. And so, as an example, in a reset, you know, bondholders would get hurt. I mean, bondholders are almost going to get hurt no matter what, whether we do it, chaotically and in an unprofessional way, or whether we decide we're going to reset it. But what I argue for in the book is that, look, yes, we need inflation. We need to either, you know, a debt jubilee where we write down the debt or we write up everything else. Both those things are kind of quote unquote inflation. But if everybody knew, and that hurts, okay, it hurt everybody. But if everybody knew it were a one-time deal and after that it wasn't going to happen again, I think people would be willing to tolerate it, you know, versus the way we're going right now. My sense is the next 10 years are going to be very inflationary and it's going to be just rough. And people are going to say, what the hell's going on? I'm continually getting fried here. And so I would propose that, you know, the enlightened leader would explain the problem, explain the solution, you know, counsel people that there will be a one-time hit, but then, you know, knowing that after that, it's going to be a lot better. So that's my proposed, you know, way through the mess. Sadly, I don't think today we have a politician who's ready to do that, although we've got some indication. I mean, Scott Bessent is a smart guy and he said he realizes there's a monetary problem and he wants to, He knows there might be a need for something like a Bretton Woods. He wants to be at the table. So maybe, just maybe, he's thinking something along these lines. I don't know. You know, another goal of the book was to get everybody educated enough to read it and, you know, maybe change the opinion in America where, hey, sound money is actually one of the issues that gets talked about. It's actually in the debates. You know what I mean? Where do you, you know, what's your view on monetary policy, Mr. Politician, Mr. Senator, Mr. Congressman, Mr. You know, Governor? How do you view the unsustainable fiscal situation that we have? How would you address it? That to me would be, you know, worthwhile. I mean, one, you might get some good ideas too. You'll just get a sense of how many of us there are out there. But I think it's not trivial. I mean, I think it's, you know, there are quite a few of us out there, you know, in the space.
Yeah, I mean, and ideas spread quickly in this day and age. And, you know, this, I agree with you. Like, I can't imagine the things you're describing, you know, these topics that are important, will take another 20 years for people to get interested in as you just continually find the 9-to-5 grind getting harder and harder and harder.
Well, that's right. And I, as I said before, I don't really think it's going to be 20 years. I think right now everyone's kind of hoping that things will go back to normal, that inflation will stay low, and that, you know, we'll be back to kind of the 80s and 90s and 2000, you know, when things were kind of under control. I don't see it that way. I see it as much more likely that inflation becomes a larger and more persistent problem. And, you know, the people really start to, I mean, the people are hurting now. I mean, imagine if we had another inflation, you know, and things haven't gone back to normal, in my view. I mean, grocery costs are very high. Imagine if we had another burst of inflation and it all got a lot worse again. You know, this is why the book is designed to get people angry about what's happened, aware of the problem. And then, you know, I'm suspecting some sound money politicians will come along. I mean, there are already a couple of them. There'll be more. And, you know, so that there'll be a sound money coalition, and they'll, all those of us who believe in sound money will donate to their campaigns and help them to do better in politics and maybe start introducing ideas that support sound money. And, you know, who knows? I mean, that was the whole goal of the book, right? To push the direction and the narrative toward this problem, which really has been ignored. I mean, we had a presidential debate, you know, two candidates. I'm like, I don't care which one you like. There was no discussion of the debt and the deficits. None, zero. Like it didn't, it's like the thing that cannot be spoken. And yet, you know, it's probably one of the largest and most pressing issues that we face right now. It's a real problem.
So yeah, I can't recommend the book enough. If you're listening and you are looking for the book to help, you know, quantify this very complicated problem and do it in a way that is, like I said, it's not a textbook. It's a well-written narrative. And congratulations, Larry, on putting this together, and the reception has been phenomenal.
Well, thank you. Yeah, no, I appreciate that. It's definitely done okay. I'm still kind of have my fingers crossed. I mean, I think, you know, your video went out for a minute. I think in terms of, you know, the Bitcoin world and, you know, the sound money world, it's been very well received. And I appreciate that. And I love all the, you know, everyone likes it. I still think it's a question mark. Can we get it in a normie world? And does normie world go, wow, this is interesting. I wasn't aware of this and I now get it. And I want to do something about it. You know what I mean? That to me, if that happens, I've had some tweets and some DMs and some others who said, hey, you know, I read this and I've changed my views. That's really what I want to have happen. I want to have more regular everyday Americans, you know, come to see what you and I can see right now. You know what I mean? And I think it's the best tool I could create to do that. And that's how I will measure success. I mean, if we can get this out more broadly to everybody, then I'll be very pleased with the success. If it just stays a Bitcoin book that all the Bitcoiners love, well, that's great. But that wasn't why I wrote it. You know what I mean?
So the book's available on Amazon. And for listeners who are trying to find you or find it anywhere else.
Actually, let me give you an update on all that. So it's on Amazon. Just Google the big print, Lawrence Lepard. It's right now, it's in hard copy, paperback, and EPUB. We just yesterday, actually, I don't know when you're going to release this video, but it's on the 24th. We sent all the 24th of March. We sent all the files to Audible/Amazon. They're the same company for the audiobook. Walker America, who's a great guy with a great voice, read it for me. I didn't have time to read it, and my voice isn't as good as his anyway. So he did all the audio recording, and so it'll be an audiobook. And I've been told that, you know, audio can be 30 or 40% of the units sold in books. So they have to check it through their systems and processes and make sure it's all up to spec. And they said, worst case, that'll be 10 days. So I'm guessing within the next, you know, half a dozen days, maybe The Audible version will be available for sale as well. It comes with a PDF, which has the charts, because there are a lot of charts that I think are important to understand the issues. And it's about, I think the Audible version will be in the 12 and a half hour range to listen to it. So look for that sometime in early April.
Very exciting. Larry, this has been a real pleasure. Thanks again so much for coming on the show for the chat.
Well, nice to see you again. I hope you go back to the next Canadian Bitcoin. I know I plan to be there. And if so, we'll sit down and have coffee.
I look forward to it. And if you're listening to the show and you made it all the way to the end of the episode, I want to thank you as well for tuning in, and hope to see you next week.
Thanks, Scott.
Thanks for listening to this episode of The Block Reward. We're trying to do something different here, creating accessible conversations meant for people who aren't obsessed with Bitcoin. If you found this episode informative and engaging, hit that subscribe button to make sure you stay updated with future episodes. Your feedback matters. We'd greatly appreciate it if you could take a moment to share your reviews and help us with our goal of creating Bitcoin content that is simple and easy to understand. Bitcoin has an important role to play in the future of finance. It will change the way we save, spend, and invest. Discover why Bitcoin offers a game-changing opportunity for forward-thinking employers by visiting blockrewards.ca. BlockRewards' mission is helping Canadian employers implement strategies for integrating Bitcoin into compensation and benefits. Supercharge your recruitment and retention strategies, and help your team members plan for the rising cost of living by rewarding their work with the hardest money ever invented. Special thanks to our top sponsor, Paramount Employee Benefits Consulting, Canada's only Bitcoin-forward benefits and pension advisory. For more information, find them at paramountbenefits.ca. Big shout out to Podigy, our production team that makes all this possible, and BMX Escape for producing our music. Bitcoin is an expansive and dense topic many people walk away from early. To Bitcoin enthusiasts looking for that podcast they can share with friends, family, and colleagues, one they'll actually listen to, we hope that is us. The content of these conversations is meant to be provided for information purposes only. Nothing here is investment advice. Bitcoin is a big topic. Be sure to do your own research before making any personal financial decisions. Thanks for listening.